Hi, friends, and welcome to another Robcast. I am so excited about this one because my belovedest, if that's a word, belovedest friend Carlton Cuse is in the back house. Welcome, Carlton.
Hello, Rob.
I have been looking forward.
Very happy to be here.
I have been looking forward to this podcast for so long.
At least 10 minutes.
Maybe even longer than that. We became friends in the spring of 2011. That's when we first met. And I just adore Carlton and his fantastic wife, Chris, and have learned so much from him. And I could go on for a long time here.
Don't let me stop you.
And so I just have, creative process, your family, your Lost. There's so many different places we could go. But Carlton, among his many things, has a new show that just came out called The Colony.
Oh, just Colony. No, The.
Colony.
Colony.
Why did I think that? Colony is, I'm warning you, friends, because after this podcast, you're going to go find it. It's on USA Network.
On USA Network.
And you're going to
Thursdays at 10 p.m. Eastern.
You're going to get sucked in, and I'm just telling you. So let's start there with the newest show, because I have all sorts of questions that will probably float around the perimeter of that. But how did the idea for this show come about?
So the idea for Colony came about because I was working with a writer named Ryan Condal, and we had developed a pilot for NBC based on a graphic novel called The Sixth Gun. And we developed a script, and we shot a pilot, and NBC did not pick it up to series. But it was one of those experiences where we just clicked creatively. We really got along really, really well. And so Ryan and I started talking about other ideas that we could do as a series. And one of the things that fascinated both of us was Paris under Nazi occupation in World War II. And we started talking about these images that existed of Parisians sitting at sidewalk cafes, nicely dressed, with Nazi stormtroopers going by on the street. And the incongruity of that was really fascinating, this idea that, you know, Paris was still this beautiful city with all these magnificent buildings, all this culture and art, and a sizable chunk of Parisians were trying to maintain some sense of normalcy in their lives, but at the same time, their city was occupied by Nazis. And there was a resistance movement, but there were also like Vichy collaborators who chose to aid the Nazis. And we started talking about how when you start thinking about occupation and colonization, this is a condition that has existed throughout human history. And if you think about it, almost every country in the world has either been a colony or a colonizer. And so we thought, well, how could we create a nice modern analog for that? And the best vehicle seemed to be science fiction. So we sort of came up with this idea that what if modern day Los Angeles was occupied by these aliens that come down and they put up these 300-foot metallic walls around the city of Los Angeles. We don't know why they're here. The people living in Los Angeles don't know why they're here. And they install a proxy human government. And, you know, sort of like us going into Afghanistan and putting Hamid Karzai in charge. He was a guy who was supposedly helping us, but he was also helping himself. So this idea that they were smart enough to put a human government in place, but that human government sort of, once empowered, very happily subjugated their fellow humans. And we thought, well, let's make an alien invasion show, but not make it about the aliens, not make it about the invasions, not make it about humans shooting guns at space creatures or anything like that. Let's make it about the human story, the human dimensions of what happens to people who live in a world where the rules of society have been upended.
Okay, so how much time did it take for the two of you to develop that premise? And was there a moment when one of you said, and what if there's like a 300-foot wall? Did one of you go, that is the dumbest idea ever? Or you're like, no, seriously, there could be a 300-foot wall. Were you laughing, or were you like, no, literally, let's have a 300-foot wall?
I think one of the great things about the creative process is that sometimes the craziest, seemingly dumbest ideas are the ones that you should really gravitate towards. And when I'm in the writer's room with other writers, I always encourage people to pitch crazy ideas, because maybe the pitch won't quite work, but usually out of that idea comes something interesting.
Something in there.
And I honestly don't even remember in the process when we started talking about the 300-foot walls. Like all writers, I think all writers are influenced by the world in which they live. So if you live in Los Angeles and you try to get across the 405 at any time after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you have no problem believing that there's a 300-foot metallic wall that runs along the 405 freeway. It's just a very natural extension and metaphor. And I don't know, we just sort of thought, like, we came up with some of these crazy things. We really loved the idea, like in District 9, there was this really great amalgam of this sort of gritty urban culture with science fiction technology,
yeah.
And we thought that that would be great. We also didn't want LA to be dystopic, and we purposely set it here because we wanted there to be palm trees and blue skies and a sort of a really cool physical environment. So many of these kinds of shows are like Blade Runner. They just show the world, you know, in this horrible place. And
yeah,
the thing that's interesting about totalitarian culture is that there are actually good things about it. So I read these accounts of people in Eastern Germany who would say, well, yes, I mean, it wasn't great living in East Germany, but we had jobs. There was a certainty to life. There was security. You know, there were certain attributes of life there that were actually appealing despite the oppressive totalitarian society that they, you know, that they lived under.
Because that's what's so jarring about Colony in the first episode is it's like this family having breakfast and the kid goes out in the backyard and gets fruit, like, I think oranges off the tree.
Yeah.
But then you realize there's like this giant barbed wire on the top of the fence in the family backyard. There's like these little pieces that you're like, whoa, wait. Or when the mom's out riding her bike and a Suburban goes by with these like sort of stormtrooper-like characters, like
the
juxtaposition of just the red hats, of like beautiful palm trees riding your bike on a sunny day, and then something very sinister is going on, and it all just sits together. Did you picture, like, how much of like set... what those black Suburbans look like, which I keep bringing up. Like, how much of that do you have from the get-go? Or is that somebody else who you just give them sort of rough pieces and they take it from there?
The wonderful thing about television is it's this immensely collaborative medium, and that's the thing that I love about it the most. I work best creatively, collaboratively. I'm not a guy who likes to go sit in a room by myself facing the blank screen and the pulsing cursor. I mean, that doesn't work for me. I really love bouncing ideas and stories with other writers and other creative people. And television requires this vast amount of creative work on a very tight schedule. And in its best version, it really is a situation where the total is greater than the sum of the parts. And so Ryan and I spent most of our time talking about the theme of the show, the sort of basic construct of how things would work. It was, you know, as you talk about it more and more, you start to build out the world, and you start to have to answer all sorts of questions about, okay, well, is there currency? How does that work? And like, what supplies do people have? And where do those supplies come from? And so we found ourselves asking and answering a lot of questions in building out the world. And we spent the first year developing the pilot, and we created a lot of the iceberg under the water in order to write the pilot. And then it took about another year between the time we started making the pilot and when we started into production on the series. So really, by the time the audience is seeing Colony, we've been working on the show for 2 years. And the result of that 2 years is that we've answered a lot of questions. So then once you actually start making the series, you hire a bunch of people. You hire production designers and costumers and vehicle dudes, and then they come to you and say, well, what do you want the vehicles to look like? What do you want the costumes to look like? And or you sort of pitch them out the idea and concept of the show, and better yet, really talented department heads will come back to you and say, well, here's what I was inspired to do based on reading the pilot, thinking about it myself. And you look at ideas, you look at versions, say, well, here's some ideas of how we would make the vehicles look badass, or here's, you know, here's how we would dress the red hats, and here's how to make them look you know, different than Nazi stormtroopers or American soldiers. We wanted to kind of create a distinct look for them. And a lot of time and effort goes into establishing the world. It's kind of mind-boggling when I look back and think about how many individual decisions had to get made to kind of make the world credible.
Okay, because when I visited you when we had tacos and then went to the set.
Yes.
I saw two different scenes get filmed from two different episodes later in the first season with two different directors and two different sets of actors. And there's like 200 people on the set. And you were moving, it appeared effortlessly, between different pages of different scripts at different points in the story with different directors actually pulling off the scenes. What is it like when you show up and there's 200 people working really hard at the top of their game to make this thing that started with you and Ryan going, let's make a 300-foot wall?
I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. So when I first started making television, the very first show I did was a show called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. And
by the way, somebody listening just went, yeah, I love that show.
It was so fun. It was actually... it was a peak experience, but since it was my first experience, I didn't realize it was a peak experience until I'd had a lot of really bad experience. It was in 1993, and it starred Bruce Campbell, who many of you probably know from the Evil Dead movies, and he was also on Burn Notice for a long time and is a genre god in many ways. And it was this crazy show that was a Western with science fiction elements. And I love, just as a storyteller, cross-genre storytelling. So it was this weird amalgam of being a Western, but it had this mystical orb and weird science fiction stuff that happened, and a fairly inexplicable mythology, which probably doesn't surprise most of you who know my work. It was really funny and fun, and it was great to make it. We shot it on the Warner Brothers lot. It was the last Western to get shot on the Warner Brothers lot. It was shot on Laramie Street. There used to be a little Western town in the back of the Warner's lot. As the studio got bigger and the company got larger, they tore it down and they put up an office tower and put up these production bungalows. But it was where Maverick was shot, and with James Garner, yeah, and all these other movies. And it was this wonderful little piece of history. But I didn't know at the time how special an experience it was. In fact, I was sort of terrified because I was thrust into the job of running a show without really knowing very much about how to run a show. And it was, you know, very much learning on the job.
And you were how old at that point?
I think like 32 or 33.
And then after that came what show?
After that, there was a few. I worked on this really... I sort of went to work as a gun for hire in a very short-lived show called Fortune Hunter, which was an international spy adventure show that was on Fox that, in a way, weirdly sort of precipitated Briscoe's cancellation. And so it was kind of going to work for, like, the enemy. It was an international action-adventure spy show, but someone had come up with a great idea that it should shoot in Orlando, Florida, which is a mangrove swamp like 30 mean feet above sea level. And so, you know, we're supposed to be down there, and I'm like, well, how are we supposed to shoot international stuff? And they go, oh, well, we'll just go to Epcot, you know? And they'd already used, like, the Moroccan Plaza at Epcot. And so by episode three, it was like people were driving around Orlando going, there's an Italian restaurant. That could be Naples. Like, that's awesome. And so it was a very poorly chosen location for the series. Anyway, that was just sometimes I think I remember this. I remember this quote by Neil Simon where he said he learned a lot more watching bad plays than good ones. And I think I learned a lot in my experience working on shows that didn't work. This was one, and there were a lot of lessons that I took from that. The next thing that I did that was really significant was I created a show called Nash Bridges that starred Don Johnson and Cheech Marin, and that ran for 6 years and 121 episodes on CBS.
Amazing.
And that shot in San Francisco, and that was a lot of fun to do. Kind of crazy. Then I created a show called Martial Law, which starred Sammo Hung, who grew up in the Peking Opera School with Jackie Chan and Arsenio Hall. And it was a kind of a buddy cop martial arts show that very much in the style of Jackie Chan's movies. In fact, the pilot was directed by a guy named Stanley Tong, who had directed Jackie Chan's three biggest movies in China or in Hong Kong prior to Rush Hour. And then after that, I kicked around. I did another show that did not work very well. I didn't create it. I just went to work as a gun for hire on a show called The Black Sash. But on that show, I met these two wonderful writers named Eddie Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. And then I went to work on Lost. And right at the very beginning, and Damon Lindelof, who had created the show with J.J. Abrams, had been a writer for me on Nash Bridges, and he was not an experienced showrunner, but he had been sort of left at the helm of the show because J.J. Abrams left to go do Mission Impossible 3 with Tom Cruise. And Damon basically, you know, called me up and was like, I need help showrunning the show. It was a massive job and he wasn't experienced doing it. So I joined up with him and, you know, kind of right around the beginning of the series. And it was just one of those things where, like, people said, you're crazy. No one thought Lost was going to work. They'd made this pilot. The pilot was fantastic, but no one was like, well, there's no series here. But I'd seen the pilot. I talked to Damon. I'd seen the first couple of scripts. I just had this real feeling in my gut that this thing could be something that would go for a long time, that was going to be successful. And I had a deal in another studio, and I went to my agent and I said, you have to get me out of my overall deal. I want to go work on Lost. And he was like, are you nuts? Like, that show is going to be like 12 and out. And I was like, but I feel passionate about it. And so I really threw kind of all these rational arguments aside, took a huge cut in pay, and went and followed my passion to go do this show. And I said to Damon, I remember we'd sit in my office every morning and eat breakfast out of these cardboard containers from the Disney commissary. And it was, and so our goal was like, well, if it's only going to be 12 episodes, let's just make the 12 coolest episodes of television ever. And the worst case scenario is it'll become this show that geeks watch, and they'll have like a DVD and they'll pass it around hand to hand. And I was very inspired by like The Prisoner, which was, I think, like 17 episodes, and Twin Peaks, which was 30 episodes. And so failure wasn't something I was afraid of, because it would still be something, in my opinion, that would have had great geek cred if it had never lasted. And the criteria really became just Damon and I sitting there saying, well, like, we'll think of ideas, and if we both think they're funny and awesome, they'll go in the show. And if one of or the other of us doesn't think it's cool, we'll keep working on it until we think it's cool. And we'll sort of make the show that the version of the show we most want to make. And, you know, Damon is a super creative and talented guy. And we, you know, just had, again, this sort of wonderful collaborative process. And we made the show that we wanted to make. And then it turned out other people liked it too. And then it happened also that it came along right at the confluence of the advent of social media. You know, there was like social media just started being born. So you had this new way of people communicating with each other over the internet. And then you had this crazy show where lots of unexplainable, mysterious, weird things were happening.
Which was all intentional.
And so it was the perfect thing for people to talk about. So those two things kind of collided in a way that I think helped make the show more popular.
So it's like Martial Law, Black Sash. It's like the stuff that, I mean, Nash Bridges went for a while, but there's some things in there that didn't catch fire, that didn't go, and then this thing that everybody around you is like, that is not a smart move, and but I'm going to do it. And then that's the one that like takes off. It's a weird path.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you have a creative life, you try your hardest with everything. And some things will be more popular than others. I mean, I always think of like Woody Allen. I mean, he's the only living person to win 3 Academy Awards for original screenplay. And he has made some absolutely brilliant movies. And he's also made some movies that aren't that good, like, honestly.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
he is capable of hitting the ball out of the park, but sometimes he strikes out. And, you know, I read an interview with him where he's basically like, he's okay with that. He makes each movie, he tries his best at it, and some connect, some work. And there's also this alchemy when you know, as I said, when you make a television show or a movie, you're doing it in collaboration with all these people. So you have to cast it well, you have to have the right crew, everyone has to, you know, get on the same page. And sometimes that's additive. Other times people are just, you know, it falls flat. People don't see the thing the same way. You don't get the right cast. You can't figure out how to tell the stories the right way. There's just a million ways in which things fail. And so, you know, you have the best intention, but it's really not fully in your control. It's not like being a novelist. If you're a novelist, you can kind of control the entire environment of your storytelling. But in television or in film, you know, you're only somewhat in control of what's going to happen.
So now you have Colony going, Strain is going.
The Strain.
As I said it, I was like, I know there's a "the" in there.
Okay.
So Colony is going, Strain is going, Bates Motel is going.
Yes, no, the Bates Motel. It is just Bates Motel.
Bates Motel.
Rotate, you know, so you do one, Bates Motel, The Strain, Colony. So, no. So, yes, I have those three shows going.
And that's 600 people, 800? That's a lot of people making a lot of television shows.
Yeah, I think there's probably about between 300 and 400 people working on each show.
So we're at 1,200 people who you are at some level overseeing.
At some level.
How do you keep your head straight? Even when I just visited that set and saw how many moving pieces there were, is it just you have great people handling this? How does your brain with that many, because you're editing stuff, you've got scripts that are being writer's room breaking down story. Scripts.
I'm sorry. Tell me your name again.
But you that's a good one. How? And then there's press, because I know. I mean, you've been. I mean, there's times I was like, "Where have you been?" And you was like, "Well, I was in Paris doing press for this show. Then I went to the filming of this show in Toronto. Then we were doing writer's room in LA for this show. Then we were in Toronto or Vancouver." How do you, at a day-to-day level, how do you keep that all straight?
I try to not think about it in too large a chunk, because otherwise it'll just like freak you out. I think that's a general rule about life I think some forward forecasting is good in life, but a lot of it isn't good.
Yeah.
Because it's just not ultimately that productive. I mean, I've found over the course of my life that, you know, thinking too far ahead doesn't get you anywhere, because sort of life has its own course and plan, and it overtakes whatever your expectations are. And so I try to I try to really reduce it down. I mean, I plan out somewhat ahead, but I sort of tackle, you know, like I look at the week and then I tackle the day. And then some days I get through everything, and some days I feel like I'm, you know, on top of the world, and other days I feel like I've been, you know, run over. It's hard given everything that I'm doing, but I kind of love the adrenaline of it all. I'm really kind of a story junkie, and I love the challenge of trying to tell all these stories. And I think one of the things that I'm good at is keeping a lot of story stuff in my head at all the time. You know, you read about like professional athletes who can remember every play that they've ever run, or, you know, I have a friend, CJ Wilson, who's a baseball player, and he can literally kind of remember like his pitching sequences to somebody he pitched to 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that for some reason I can keep story stuff in my head. I can keep a lot of story stuff in my head and keep it segregated and separated, and then it just, and I love that process of being able to jump around and work collaboratively with a lot of really talented writers and make these shows, you know?
So if I said, like episode mid 40s of Lost, you would, and we like gave you the name of the episode, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's the episode where da 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 happens.
Well, what's interesting is that once it's actually made, then it kind of gets put in.
Oh, interesting.
It gets put in a little bit of a different place. Now, I mean, Damon probably could. I mean, Damon has this, his memory is, you know, even better than mine. And he probably could remember every single detail of every Lost episode.
121 episodes. He would be able to go back through it and be like, this happened, then this happened.
Yeah. I mean, I do a really good job of keeping everything current in my brain. Like you know, right now I've got 10 episodes of The Strain and 10 episodes of Bates Motel and a game plan for season 2 of Colony, which just got picked up today in my brain.
Is that public? I guess it's public now.
It's public, yeah. No, it was announced a few hours ago.
What's that like when you've created something, the first season gets green-lighted and then the second season gets green-lighted? What was that news like today?
It's awesome. That's the biggest hurdle in the sort of successful longevity of any series is getting that first renewal, because it makes the audience feel like, okay, I can invest in the show. It's going to be around for a while. Yeah. It also means that by making that second season of television that, you know, more people kind of become aware of it. You know, we live in an environment now where there's, I think, something around 410 scripted television shows between network, cable, streaming services. And I mean, it's overwhelming. Nobody can watch all of them. I mean, I was just at the Television Critics Association, and people who are professional television reviewers can't watch all the shows that are on television. And so how do you expect an audience to find your show? So having it on over a longer period of time, you know, people then can finally find it. So
yeah.
I think for all those, and also the first season of any television show, you're trying to figure it out creatively. You're trying to find it. You're trying to figure out what's going to make it work. And I think the first season of Colony is good, and I am really proud of it, but I think the second season will be even better because we learned a lot making the first season of the show. So having that opportunity to do it a second time is just great on all those levels. It's, you know, the audience is ready, the audience knows that it's there, the audience is hopefully more invested, you do a better job, like all those things are great.
So when you're working on Colony, first 10 episodes, and are you already in those first 10 episodes? Are you and Ryan having ideas about season 2? Are there things where you're like, oh, wait, let's not do that now. Let's save that.
A little bit. I mean, and certainly when we talked about the world construction, you know, like, who are these aliens? Why are they here? What are they up to? How long are they staying?
Which
what
we get
they,
nothing
what
about
are they
so
doing?
Far.
Not
at
very
least
much.
What I've seen in season one. We get
You get a little bit as the season goes along, but you don't get all the answers this year. But we have the answers to those questions, and so then we start talking about, well, when are we going to tell the audience that? When are we going to answer that question? When are we going to explain that? And then we sort of roughly map it out. But again, running a TV show is a little bit like taking a road trip. Like you basically say, okay, we're going to go from here to Grand Rapids, Michigan, one of New York Times' 52 most, you know, places that you must visit this year, former home of Rob Bell. And but you might say, okay, well, I know that I'm going to go to Las Vegas and Denver and Kansas City and Wall Drug in South Dakota, and then I'm going to go over to Michigan. But on any given day, you might get up and you're going to decide, I'm going to take the rural back roads, or I'm going to take the interstate. And you leave yourself a lot of latitude for exploration, for detours, for side adventures. You're ultimately going to get to that same place. But those adventures along the way also might inform the rest of the journey, and probably will. And it might determine what you do, how you're traveling, what you're doing while you're traveling. And making a TV show is very much the same way. You have kind of a general game plan, but you give yourself a lot of latitude to adjust on the fly. At least I've learned that, because it's a very organic process. Like you, like certain actors, like on Colony, we just fell into the fact that Josh Holloway and Sarah Wayne Callies had this fantastic relationship. They had coincidentally done a movie 10 years ago together, and they really connected and they had a lot of chemistry. So we didn't have to put a lot of energy in the show into making the audience understand why they were married.
Yeah.
It was just there innately,
just there
in the chemistry between
them. From the beginning, sure.
And so that was, you know, we'd also in the original script had made them, had made their relationship a little more alienated. But once we saw them together, they weren't alienated from each other. They had this connection. So then we, Ryan and I, adjusted the dialogue and the nature of their relationship to reflect the kind of chemistry they had with each other, as opposed to forcing the actors to play something that we had created in the abstract.
So literally the actors show up and the thing be happening between the actors, the two of you are like, whoa, we have to now go forward in the episodes because there's a thing
that
they're just their presence between each other is going
to
affect the dialogue going forward. Now, so do you have like the last scene of season two? Do you have the, oh my word, this is how it ends, cliffhanger, everything blows up, the aliens turn out to be green? I don't know what it, did you, do you have that in your head?
For season two or for the end of the series?
Do you have both?
Yes, we definitely know where, well, season one is already shot, so
sure, right.
It's all
so that's
done.
Yep.
And then, yes, we know what the end point of season two is. And then we know, we have kind of the big idea of what we want to do at the end of Colony the series. I mean, I won't say that we have the exact formulation of the last image or where it's going to go, but we know what we want to do at the end. Like, we have, like, oh, that's cool. That's how we should end this show. We have that idea.
So all the people watching their favorite shows, and there's the end of season one, there's the end of season two, that I just love that when I've seen something and I'm, oh, that's how it ends. That's, you already are carrying around these kinds of that stuff.
I think you kind of have to. I mean, one of the keys to writing, and I think it's super true in movie writing and maybe a little bit less of a necessity in television writing, is you kind of got to know where you're ending, you know, where you're going. You may not need all of the specific details, but you have to have a general concept and idea of what your ending is. And as I said, it's like, you know, you're driving to Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's not like, well, we're just getting in our car and
yeah,
maybe we're going to end up in Maine and maybe we'll end up in Tampa. You know, that's not as good.
So the idea that, oh, I'm just figuring it out as I go along. Like, no, you need as the creator to have to know where it's going to land.
But you're also figuring out as you go along,
yeah,
because, you know, creative process is additive. And the more you think about a show and the more time you spend working on a show, the more ideas you get. And you want to add those in and build the world and make it, you know, better,
yeah,
because you're thinking about it all the time.
Yeah.
But hopefully you're moving towards that particular endpoint and you don't wake up one day and go, oh no, like, this is not going to work at all. This is terrible. And I know there's people out there who probably are Lost fans who are going like, what are you talking about? But we had a very clear idea of what we wanted to do at the end. We knew, for instance, at the end, I mean, the show opened at the end of Lost, like, we knew that Lost opened with Jack's eye popping open, and then it ended with Jack's eye popping, going closed. And we had that from the very beginning. And then we knew that he died at the end. And then, you know, we started adding ideas, and really early on, we had this sort of subset of ideas of what we wanted to accomplish in the ending. But that show was a mystery, and it was a, you know, by the time, if you think about it, we did 121 episodes of Lost over 6 years, and the yarn ball of mystery had gotten so large by the end, there was no version of the ending of that show that could have been sort of just answering all the mysteries that wouldn't have been really didactic and boring,
yeah,
and
right,
uninspiring. And ultimately, you know, life doesn't answer all of your questions. I mean, that's the, you know, so it didn't seem to be a reasonable expectation that the show needed to either. You know, there's plenty of mystery that informs our lives, and that's okay. And we were much more interested in really exploring how the characters' journeys were going to end. And that was where we put our focus. And I was well aware at the time that not everybody would love it, and I was okay with that. And there was actually no version of the ending of Lost that everybody would have been happy with.
Right.
And I think if you're a storyteller and you're taking big swings and you're trying to do something significant, you have to accept the fact that not everybody's going to like it. If you're trying to make something that everybody's going to like, I think you're probably going to make something that's kind of
yes.
insipid.
So when Lost ended and you had just poured your life into 121 episodes, if I would have said, oh, like 5 years from now, 6 years from now, you're going to have
three TV
all
shows.
These shows going, 1,200 people are going to be working to take these ideas and bring these stories to life. What would you have said to that?
I would have said, Rob Bell, you're crazy. I would have said, there is no chance that this will happen. No, I mean, I had absolutely no intention of being this like multiple show producer. What happens in Hollywood is it's really painful for like my friends who are screenwriters in the feature business, because you can make a really nice living as a screenwriter in Hollywood and work for many, many years and never get anything made.
Right.
You know, Ryan Condal, who is an unbelievably talented writer and wonderful guy and incredibly creative, you know, worked as a feature writer for many, many years, and he had one credit on this movie, Hercules, with Dwayne Johnson. But he was always working and writing. But from the outside, you're like, people go like, well, what are the movies you wrote? And you're like, well, they haven't all gotten made. And that's what happens. There's so much stuff that's developed that doesn't get made. So if you're a writer in Hollywood, you have to have like five or six projects at all times. You have to have a whole bunch of things that you're working on, because most everything fails. So I went through this weird period where I had my like four or five projects and like hardly anything failed. Like everything went forward. So that's how I ended up with multiple shows.
It's incredible. It's incredible. Now, do you have, if your head wasn't full of the 5,000 things it's full of, do you have ideas percolating all the time? I might pursue like this story or this pilot or that series or.
Yeah, I mean, I get ideas and then I write them down and, you know, on pieces of paper, and I, you know, put them in like a file, and like hopefully I'll go back to them at some point. And sometimes you go back and you go, oh, that's a cool idea. Other times you go like, I don't even remember thinking of that. And other times like, that's terrible, you know. So
you have a file. You have a file in your office at home.
I do.
And it's scraps of paper.
Yeah.
And it's just two guys are fixing a flat tire, but one of them has three arms or whatever. And
yeah,
I mean, is it just that like little pieces of stuff?
Two guys are doing a podcast and they decide, let's go prospect for gold.
And it's all just sitting there.
It's all just sitting there. Yeah. I mean,
I love it. I love it.
And who knows, you know, whether I'll get to, you know, any of those things or all of those things. You know, it's just a career in Hollywood only makes sense in hindsight. You know, it just.
That's very interesting.
You just don't know. Like you, I really have given up trying to be too predictive about what's going to happen. I've also become much more instinctual. I used to kind of try to think about, you know, what it is that I want to do and why I should do this or that. And now it's much more just like if I get an idea, or if someone pitches me an idea and it really sticks with me and I start thinking about it a lot and I find myself coming back to it and thinking about it more and more, then I'll pursue it. I'll work on it. But I don't think that much about, well, what are the consequences of this? Will this be marketable? Is this going to work? It's much more about, do I feel some emotional connection, some passion? If I can find some passion for it. Like, probably nobody thought it was a very good idea to do the like fourth remake of a sequel to Psycho. You know, that was not probably, people were going like, wow, the world is waiting for this. There had been several movie sequels which had not been successful. There, in fact, had been a Bates Motel TV show which was not successful. And but the idea kept churning around in my brain. And then I sat down with this writer, Carrie Aaron, and we just started talking about, wow, is there a way to really sort of subvert expectations about this show? And like, Norma Bates is this really interesting character because she's like one of the most famous characters in cinema, but you never see her alive. Like, she's just a corpse. And well, what if, like, instead, you know, you're imagining this movie and you're thinking, oh, this woman was this horrible shrew who berated her kid into, you know, he berated her kid until he went insane. But what if that wasn't the case? What if she was this wonderful, complex, loving, yes, slightly crazy woman who has a son with a flaw in his DNA, and she just loves him more than anything in the world, and her smothering affection kind of helps catalyze his craziness, but it's not the cause of it. And there's this tragic love story of two people who love each other so much, but ultimately are destined, you know, to have like a bad end. You know, so it's a tragedy. And like, so it's like, oh, this is really cool. Like, we'll take these two characters and we'll completely subvert expectations and we'll kind of reimagine the mythology. And by the way, we'll make it contemporary and not set it in 1960. You know, so like stuff like that. So, you know, you start having an idea, you start thinking about something, and it becomes very different than what it might seem
right
on the surface.
Right. And then you go with it.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Okay, this has been so great. Everybody, Colony, the series. I love for how many people who are doing work that they love when they tell how they got to this point.
Yeah.
There's so many twists and turns. There was no grand plan.
No.
It was sort of fumbling around in the dark, or I always like it's falling down a flight of stairs, and yet somehow it all works out. It's just such a great mystery. That's
indeed.
That's what I hearing the story again. I always come back to that. So thank you so much for being on
Well,
the
thanks,
Robcast.
Rob. It's awesome to be talking with you on your podcast. And I have to add, Rob is absolutely one of my favorite people in the world. And
oh, that's
you know
very
one of the
of you.
One of the you know the blessings of you know kind of my job is that you know we. We just crossed paths and you know got to be friends and you know it's you know I'm sure all of you listening you know really share my admiration and love for Rob and what he does. So anyway, thanks for checking this out and talk to you soon.
How fantastic is that? Bye bye everybody. Thank you, Carlton.
Thanks, Rob.